A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I want to start with the water. Actual water, dripping on me while I slept. 2 weeks of towels and buckets, and eventually just surrendering to the couch. And when I finally asked for a timeline, which the law says I'm allowed to do, the landlord's response wasn't a repair date. It was an email saying our lease wouldn't be renewed, not a plumber, an eviction notice.
This is the second home you and Hannah have lived in together since you got married. The first one ended because the landlord decided to give the apartment to a daughter who lived there for, what, a few months?
We spent an entire summer hunting for this place, believing this would be the bridge to buying something. And now I'm out there again, moving boxes on professional equipment in the sun, because the last move cost so much I'm doing this one myself. And somewhere in the middle of all that, a thought surfaced. Quiet, not dramatic. Just, this is a form of repeat trauma.
That's a clinical word, corn. You don't use it lightly.
I don't, but I also don't know what else to call it. The same boxes, the same belongings, the same weekends trudging through bleak rental viewings, paying fees to agents that are manifestly illegal, but unavoidable, because tenant reform in this country was gutted before it ever took effect. There's a visceral despair in that cycle, and I think it's really hard to understand if you've lived in one house for a decade, or if your landlord fixes the roof when it leaks.
You sent us this question, and it's really two questions. One, is this actually trauma? Has anyone studied it? And two, if it is real, what do you do about it when the market itself isn't changing anytime soon?
Because you can't tell someone in this situation not to worry about it. The feeling is that you're being punished for daring to exist in a system designed to crush you financially. And I wanted to know whether that feeling has a name, a mechanism, and maybe a response that's more useful than just keep packing.
Here's what we need to nail down first. This isn't about moving being stressful. Moving for a new job, for a relationship, because you bought a place. Those are chosen. What you're describing is involuntary, repeated displacement driven by structural failures you have zero control over. That's a completely different category of experience.
The distinction matters because the stress of a planned move has a horizon. You know when it ends. What I've been living doesn't have that. The lease ends because the landlord's daughter wants the apartment for a semester abroad. The lease ends because you ask for a roof that doesn't leak. There's no narrative to it. It's just random.
Which is exactly what makes Israel such a useful case study. We're not an outlier in having expensive housing. What's unusual is the combination. 70% of young adults rent. The default legal framework is tenancy at will, meaning the landlord can simply decide not to renew and you have no recourse. And on top of that, you've got agency fees, one full month's rent just to view an apartment, that are technically illegal but functionally mandatory because the reform that was supposed to ban them was gutted before implementation.
The lawyer I spoke to confirmed that. You can sue the landlord, but only after your lease ends. Which is a beautiful piece of Kafka, because by the time you can sue, you've already paid the illegal fee. You've already moved, and you're just supposed to go back and litigate for fun while unpacking boxes in your new place.
The system isn't just expensive. It's designed to remove any sense of security of tenure. And that's where your trauma hypothesis gets interesting, because the psychological profile you're describing lines up with what we know about repeated, unpredictable stressors where the subject has no escape route. A degraded sense of home. Those aren't metaphors. Those are documented responses.
That's what I felt in the middle of packing. Not just tired. Something closer to, why am I even unpacking these boxes at the new place when I know I'll be repacking them in 2 years? It's a kind of environmental disinvestment that happens before you even arrive.
That's the thing we need to trace through the actual research, because your intuition might just be correct, but let's see what the data says. I went digging through the literature, and the first thing that landed was a 2023 study in the Journal of Urban Health. 1,200 renters tracked over 4 years. The finding that stopped me cold each involuntary move in the prior 2 years increased the odds of moderate to severe psychological distress by 27%, and that's after controlling for income and baseline mental health.
27% per move. So if you've had 3 forced moves in 5 years, which is exactly my timeline, you're not just accumulating inconvenience, you're stacking risk.
That's precisely what the data shows. A dose-response relationship. More moves, more distress. And the key word in the methodology was involuntary. They separated out people who moved by choice, and the effect vanished for that group. Planned relocation, even when stressful, doesn't produce the same psychological signature.
The first move felt like bad luck. The second, when I asked for a roof repair and got an eviction notice instead, landed differently. It felt like proof that the system wasn't just unlucky, it was rigged.
That's where the mechanism gets specific. When a threat is unpredictable, your brain processes it through the same neural pathways as a predator encounter. The amygdala doesn't distinguish between a landlord's aggressive email and something physically dangerous. It just registers threat, no escape, no pattern to learn from.
You're saying my landlord is neurologically equivalent to a bear?
I'm saying your amygdala thinks so. And the problem is, with a bear, the encounter ends. With rental instability, the threat just keeps recurring on someone else's schedule. You never habituate to it because you can't predict when the next non-renewal is coming. That's what produces the chronic low-grade hypervigilance you were describing.
The packing anxiety. I didn't have a name for it, but that's exactly what it felt like. Every time I looked at a box, some part of my brain was already calculating how soon I'd be filling it again.
There's actually a name for the broader phenomenon. Sociologist Anthony Giddens called it ontological security. It's the confidence that your immediate environment is stable and predictable, that the basic continuities of your life will hold. Home is the foundation of that. When forced moves shatter it, what you get isn't just sadness about leaving. It's a deeper destabilization. The ground keeps shifting and you stop trusting that it'll ever stay still.
That's the part I think people who own their homes genuinely don't see. It's not about the physical space. It's about whether you can make any plan that extends beyond the lease end date. Can I plant something? Can I paint this wall? Can I let my kid feel like this is his room? Or am I already preparing him for the next one?
The Israeli data bears this out. The Israel Democracy Institute ran a survey in 2024. 43% of Israeli renters said housing instability had negatively affected their mental health. 28% reported symptoms that met the threshold for clinical anxiety. That's nearly a third of renters walking around with diagnosable anxiety, and the primary driver wasn't cost. It was insecurity of tenure.
The cost is bad enough, but it's the randomness that eats at you. You can budget for expensive rent. You can't budget for your landlord deciding on a Tuesday that your lease is over because you asked for a functioning roof.
Which brings us to what the OECD called, in a 2025 housing policy brief, the squeezed middle renter. You earn too much to qualify for housing assistance, but you don't earn enough to absorb a move that costs 15 or 20,000 shekels. So you fall through the gap. The means testing creates a cliff edge, and you're standing right on it.
That's exactly what happened. The authorities were indifferent because on paper we looked fine. But paper doesn't capture the fact that a single forced move can wipe out your savings and consume a month of your life in viewings and logistics. And when it happens twice in 5 years, you're not building anything. You're just running to stay in place.
That's the thing the research keeps confirming. This isn't just subjective misery. It's a measurable, replicable psychological harm produced by a specific mechanism, unpredictable, involuntary displacement with no escape route. Your intuition was correct. The data supports it.
If the research says this is trauma adjacent, or at minimum a clinically significant stressor, the question becomes, what do we actually do about it? Because the Gazette isn't passing tenant reform tomorrow, and I've still got boxes to pack.
Here's what the research keeps pointing toward. The harm doesn't stop at the move itself. It cascades outward into every other life decision. The Taub Center published a study last year. Israeli renters delay homeownership by an average of 4.3 years compared to peers in rent-controlled markets, but they also marry later. They have fewer children. And when you control for income, the gap persists, which means it's not about being able to afford kids, it's about not having the stability to plan for them.
We felt that directly. Hannah and I are both in our late 30s. Ezra is one. We made that decision in a rental we believed would be a bridge to ownership, and now that bridge is gone. And you start doing the math. Another move now, another lease cycle, another period of recovery, and suddenly you're looking at buying when you're in your 40s, if at all.
That's the stalled life effect. It's not just the move. It's the cumulative delay of everything that requires a stable address. The Taub Center data shows this isn't a preference. Israeli renters want to buy at roughly the same rates as renters elsewhere. They just can't, because the instability itself consumes the resources that would otherwise go toward a down payment.
Which loops back to the squeeze middle trap. Every forced move costs thousands of shekels in fees, moving costs, lost workdays. That's money that could have been a down payment. Instead, it's going to an agent who charged me a month's rent for the privilege of opening a door.
Speaking of those agents, let's talk about the legal system, because this is where the failure gets truly Kafkaesque. Israel passed a tenant protection reform in 2017 that was supposed to ban those fees and establish minimum lease terms. It was gutted before implementation. Lobbying, political horse trading, whatever the mechanism, the result is that the law on the books says one thing, and the reality on the ground is something else entirely.
The lawyer I consulted was well-intentioned, and their advice was, sue the landlord, but only after your lease ends. Which I understand from a legal strategy perspective. You don't want retaliation while you're still living there. But the practical effect is that the legal system is structurally inaccessible to the people it's supposed to protect, because by the time you can use it, you've already absorbed all the harm.
There's a darker layer to this. Haaretz ran an investigation in 2024 and found 12 private databases circulating among Israeli landlords. These are informal blacklists tracking tenants who filed complaints, requested repairs, or taken legal action. No regulation, no oversight, no right of reply. If you sue your landlord, even justifiably, your name ends up on a list and suddenly nobody will rent to you.
Which means the lawyer's advice to wait until after the lease ends isn't just about strategy. It's about survival in a market where landlords share intelligence on tenants like with credit risks. You're not a person with a leaking roof. You're a litigious tenant. That's the label, and it follows you.
That's the thing about the legal system. It's not that the laws don't exist, it's that the enforcement mechanism is broken in a way that makes exercising your rights a threat to your future housing, so you don't exercise them. You pay the illegal fee, you fix the roof yourself, you move quietly, and the cycle continues.
We ended up making Save the Column ourselves, the one they dug into to find the source of the leak. We paid for it, we coordinated it, we lived displaced with a relative for weeks with a distressed one-year-old, and the landlord's contribution to that process was the email saying our lease wouldn't be renewed.
Now let's go back to that voice in your head while you were packing. This is a form of repeat trauma. There's actually a clinical name for what you were experiencing. Psychologists studying disaster survivors found that the act of dismantling one's home activates the same grief pathways as bereavement. Packing your belongings under threat of displacement isn't just a chore. It's a grieving process without closure.
That's exactly what it felt like. Bereavement without a funeral. Because when someone dies, there's an ending. You grieve, and eventually you rebuild. But with this, the grief doesn't end because the threat doesn't end. You aren't back in the new place, and some part of you is already preparing for the next loss.
The research on disaster survivors points to something crucial. In bereavement, closure is a protective factor. It's what allows the grief to process and integrate. Rental instability is open-ended by definition. There is no closure because there's no final move. There's just the next lease, the next landlord, the next uncertainty, so the grief stays fresh.
Which is why some renters, and I've caught myself doing this, start adopting what I'd call a permanently backed lifestyle. You don't hang pictures, you don't paint. You keep things in boxes in the storage closet because you might need them again in 18 months. It feels adaptive, like you're being smart and prepared. But it also means you never actually arrive.
Psychologists have a term for this too. It's a coping strategy called micro-moves. You keep your life in a state of perpetual readiness. Possessions stay in boxes, spaces stay generic, you avoid personalizing, and on one level it works. It reduces the logistical pain of the next move. But it's pathological in the deeper sense because it prevents the formation of home attachment, and home attachment is itself a protective factor for mental health. It's one of the things that buffers against anxiety and depression, so you're trading short-term logistical relief for long-term psychological vulnerability.
That's the trap. If I let myself feel at home, the next move hurts more. If I don't let myself feel at home, I'm living in a state of permanent emotional suspension. Neither option is healthy, and the market forces you to choose between them.
Here's the thing that makes this particularly maddening. It doesn't have to be this way. Let's look at Germany. 80% of the population rents. That's higher than Israel. But their default lease is a 5-year minimum with rent control and just-cause termination requirements. A landlord can't decide on a Tuesday that your lease is over because you asked for a roof repair. And the mental health data reflects this. A 2024 Cross European study found that German renters report 60% lower housing-related anxiety than Israeli renters, controlling for income.
60% lower. Same proportion of renters, same basic activity of paying someone else to live in their property, but a completely different psychological experience. Because the unpredictability has been regulated out of the system.
And that's the counterfactual that matters. When people say this is just how renting is, or that the stress is inevitable, Germany is the answer. It's not inevitable. It's policy-driven. The anxiety Israeli renters are experiencing is a product of specific legal choices, and different choices produce different outcomes.
Which is both encouraging and infuriating. Encouraging because it means this is fixable. Infuriating because we've known how to fix it for decades, and the reform keeps getting gutted.
There's a bill pending in the Knesset right now. It would mandate 5-year minimum leases with just cause termination. It's basically the German model adapted for Israeli law. Whether it survives the committee process is an open question, but the fact that it exists at all is a sign that the conversation is shifting.
That's the tension we're sitting in. The research is clear. The harm is real and measurable. The solution exists and is implemented successfully elsewhere. But in the meantime, people are packing boxes today. People are paying illegal fees today. People are lying awake wondering if the next email from the landlord is going to upend their lives. So what actually helps right now, while we wait for the Knesset to maybe do the right thing? Let's get practical, because the Knesset bill might pass, might not. But I've got boxes to pack and a brain that's already bracing for the next cycle. What actually helps?
There's an approach emerging in clinical circles, being used by therapists who work with housing, insecure populations. They're calling it rental resilience therapy. It's cognitive behavioral at its core, but adapted specifically for this situation. Three techniques keep showing up.
I'm listening.
First is compartmentalizing the move. Treat it as a discrete project with a start date, an end date, and a checklist, not as an identity crisis. The psychological damage comes partly from the move consuming your entire mental landscape. You stop being a parent, a spouse, a professional. You become just a person who is moving. The intervention is literally drawing a boundary around it. These are the moving hours. Outside those hours, you are not a mover. You are everything else you are.
That's harder than it sounds when there's water dripping on your bed.
Of course it is. But the principle holds even in crisis. Second technique, portable home rituals. A consistent morning routine that survives the move. Same coffee, same order of operations, same 10 minutes of something that isn't packing and isn't logistics. The ritual becomes the home when the physical space can't be.
That one I've stumbled into without naming it. There's a particular way I make coffee that's followed me through 3 apartments. I didn't realize I was doing therapy.
And the third one is the hardest. Strategic non-attachment to physical space, paired with deliberate investment in relationships and routines. The research on disaster survivors shows that people who anchor their identity in community rather than property recover faster. The home isn't the walls. The home is the people and the patterns.
Which is a lovely thought and also difficult to practice when you've just painted a nursery and then had to leave it.
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying the data suggests it's protective. And you ask what helps right now. This is what the clinicians are seeing.
What about the thing I've been doing? The not unpacking? The keeping things in boxes? You said that's pathological.
It is in the long term. But there's a middle ground. Some therapists recommend what they call the one-room rule. You fully settle one room. One space that feels finished, personalized, yours. Even if the rest stays provisional. It gives you a foothold for home attachment without the full vulnerability of investing everywhere.
That I can actually do. Ezra's room, maybe. Make that one real.
That's exactly the kind of thing. Now, the second intervention is completely different, and it addresses the helplessness specifically. Israeli tenant unions have grown 300% since 2022. That's not a policy change. That's people deciding they're done being isolated.
I've seen the Facebook groups. People sharing which landlords to avoid, which agents charge illegal fees, which buildings have maintenance issues. It felt like venting, honestly. But you're saying it's more than that.
It's the opposite of venting. Venting is passive. Organizing is active. The psychological mechanism here is that learned helplessness requires isolation. When you believe you're the only one experiencing this, the system feels personal and inescapable. When you realize your neighbor has the same story, and the person three blocks over has the same story, the framing shifts. It's not you. It's the structure, and structures can be pressured.
There's a practical benefit, too. If someone warns you that a particular landlord has a history of non-renewal after repair requests, you just saved yourself 2 years of your life.
Collective bargaining is starting to happen as well. Groups of tenants in the same building negotiating lease terms together. It's nascent, but it's growing. And the act of being part of a collective response rather than a solitary victim directly counteracts the helplessness pathway.
Which brings me to the third thing, and this one I learned the hard way. The Move Fund.
Tell me about that.
After the last move was ruinously expensive, I started reading what financial planners recommend for renters in unstable markets. The consensus is 3 months' rent plus moving costs, kept liquid, never touched for anything else. And the reason isn't just financial. It's psychological. When the landlord's email arrives, your cortisol response is partly about the cost. If you know the money is there, the threat downgrades from catastrophic to annoying. You're still upset, but you're not panicked.
Financial precarity amplifies the trauma response. The 2023 Journal of Urban Health study controlled for income, but what it didn't fully capture is the buffer effect. Having a move fund doesn't prevent the move, but it prevents the move from also being a financial crisis. And that separation matters enormously for mental health outcomes.
It took me 2 moves and a lot of stress to figure that out. I wish someone had told me after the first one.
For policymakers, here's the thing that keeps getting lost. The single most impactful intervention isn't rent control. It's just cause eviction laws. When a landlord must prove cause to non-renew, the unpredictability drops. And when the unpredictability drops, the mental health burden drops with it. The German comparison proves this. Their rents aren't cheap, but their tenants aren't terrified.
The Knesset bill that's pending right now does exactly that. 5-year minimum leases, just cause termination. If you're listening in Israel and this resonates, contact your MK. It's not abstract. There's an actual bill with an actual number, and it needs actual support.
Join a tenant union. Even if you're not the organizing type, even if you just lurk in the group and read the warnings about bad landlords, being informed is itself a form of protection. The Haaretz investigation found 12 blacklists of tenants. There's no reason tenants can't maintain their own.
The last thing I want to say is for anyone who's in this right now, packing boxes in the sun, feeling that visceral despair, the voice in your head that says this is a form of repeat trauma, it's correct. Don't minimize it. Don't let anyone tell you it's just moving and everyone deals with it. The research backs you up. The despair is real. And acknowledging it is the first step to managing it.
Because the alternative, the thing too many renters do, is internalize it as personal failure. If I'd saved more, if I'd negotiated better, if I hadn't asked for the roof repair. That's the helplessness talking. The data says this is structural. It's not you. We've named it, we've got the research, we've got tools, but I keep coming back to that image you opened with, water dripping on you while you slept, 2 weeks of that, and the answer wasn't a repair, it was an eviction.
That image is going to stay with me for a long time, not because of the water, but because of what it represented. The moment you realize the person who's supposed to maintain the roof over your head sees you not as a tenant, but as a liability to be managed or discarded.
We didn't solve that today. We didn't fix the market or pass the Knesset bill or make the illegal fees disappear, but we did something that matters. We named it. Your intuition was correct. The research confirms it, and naming a thing is the first step to surviving it.
There's something about hearing your own experience reflected back with data behind it. It doesn't change the boxes in the sun, but it changes whether you feel crazy while you're backing them.
Here's the question I want to leave hanging. The research is clear on the harm. We've got studies from multiple countries, multiple methodologies, all pointing in the same direction. Housing instability produces measurable psychological damage through a specific mechanism, unpredictability. The policy fix exists and works elsewhere. Germany proved it. So what would it actually take for a society to treat housing stability as a mental health intervention? Not as a nice to have, not as a market outcome, but as a public health measure on par with clean water.
Because right now we treat it as a commodity, and the policy response lags by decades. The research is there, the harm is documented, and we're still having the same conversation we were having 10 years ago, while another generation of renters develops packing anxiety.
Which brings me to the thought I can't shake. Ezra is 1 year old. He's in the middle of this move right now, distressed, displaced, living with relatives while his parents fix a column the landlord should have fixed. And the question is, by the time he rents his first apartment, will any of this have changed? Will he be dealing with the same illegal fees, the same tenancy, at will, the same blacklists?
That's the one that keeps me up. Not the move itself. The question of whether my son will be sitting in this same conversation 20 years from now, packing the same boxes, having the same realization that asking for a functioning roof can cost you your home.
That's the question that should keep policymakers up at night. Not the housing starts numbers or the mortgage rates. Whether the kid who's 1 year old today, sleeping in a borrowed apartment because his parents' landlord wouldn't fix a leak, grows up into a system that still works exactly the same way.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A 12th century manuscript known as the Speculum Regale, composed in Norway, contains one of the earliest European descriptions of jellyfish in the waters off Newfoundland. The author, likely a cleric, describes translucent creatures that appear in summer and vanish by autumn, noting with some puzzlement that they seem to have no beginning and no end, simply dissolving into the sea. He appears to have witnessed the Medusa stage of a local Cyphozoan without ever observing the attached polyp phase, which remained unknown to European naturalists for another 6 centuries.
A Norwegian monk confused by jellyfish off the coast of Newfoundland. That's a whole mood.
I have so many questions about what a 12th century Norwegian was doing in Newfoundland.
Yet none of them are about jellyfish. This has been my weird prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own prompt, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.